Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, both now and ever, and to age of ages. Amen. Okay, so tonight we're going to look at the topic of Bible translations. And I have a few things to pull up on my screen to help us go through the topic a little more efficiently here. So let me see. Let's see. Share screen. Okay, so first of all, general introduction to the topic. Hopefully you can all see this. Let me make it a little bigger. Okay. Ooh, okay, there it is. All right, can you all see that all right? That's somewhat visible. Okay, so introduction to the Bible. So before we start talking about Bible translations, we got to talk about what is the Bible in general. So the Bible, the word Bible is from the Greek vivlos, vivlion, different forms of it in Greek, masculine or neuter there, but just refers to a book, either profane or sacred, usually in the form of a scroll or a clay tablet. That would be in Old Greek. Later Greek, in Christian Greek, it would refer to a codex, to the thing that we call a book today with a sewing in the back and all of that. Okay, so the Bible. What is the Bible? It's the book. The book. For Christians, it would be Agion Vivlion, the holy book, right? Or Agios Vivlios. All right, so the canon of the Bible. What books are in the Bible? So the Bible is actually a collection of books, and we have a canon. This is where there's, a lot of confusion. The word canon. So the word canon, Greek kana, from which is just transliteration from the Hebrew kane, which is word for a cane or a reed or a stick, which they used to use for measuring. Kind of a remnant of that idea would be the teacher's yardstick up there on the board. I don't even know if they had them anymore. When I was a kid in school, the teacher always had a yardstick up there at the board, used for various purposes, one for measuring, others for discipline. But so the stick, you know, think about it when you're measuring something. If you don't have a tape measure around or a ruler, you're going to grab a stick or something elongated and you're going to use it to measure this and compare it to that. So that's what they did. They had a stick, measuring stick. So it just means measurement really more than anything in its root in the sense of its, you know, functionality here. But it comes to be known as the list of books that are in our Bible. So where do we get them? So first of all, most people have in their Bibles an Old Testament, which is at most typically 76 books, though some people have more, some people have less, depending on what kind of Old Testament you have. And then a New Testament, 27 books. And for the most part, the New Testament, the Christian scriptures, is pretty much stable across the board as far as Christian denominations go. The Old Testament, you're going to see variations. The Old Testament is made up of the Pentateuch or Torah, Pentateuch meaning referring to the five books of the Torah, the five books of the law or the Torah is a better translated, not law, but as catechesis or direction, teaching. And that's, of course, associated with Moses in various degrees. Historical books. So those are the books like, for example, Joshua and Judges and 1 and 2 Samuel. Not to say that the Torah does not have historical books. The Torah does. Genesis, Numbers are historical. Exodus are historical books. That is, they have a historical narrative. Whereas something like a large part of Exodus, the latter part of the book of Exodus, the book of Leviticus, and then large sections of Deuteronomy, parts of Numbers, would be non-historical. That is, they're just, they're not telling you a historical narrative, a story, but giving you information about, for example, the sacrificial laws, etc. Okay, so the historical books, most people normally think the historical books, you think of something like, again, Judges, Joshua, Ruth, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, or Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah. All right. So then also the wisdom books. The wisdom books are, you know, at least you're going to throw in there in that category the Proverbs, Book of Proverbs, and the Book of Wisdom, depending on your canon, the Book of Sirach or Ecclesiasticus, also Ecclesiastes. And typically the books of Job and Psalms are thrown in there for lack of a better category. And then prophets, the books of the prophets. The books of the prophets, obviously that's pretty easy. Isaiah, Jeremiah, things like that. But if you read the New Testament, when you hear the New Testament authors or New Testament characters referring to the Hebrew scriptures, they'll refer to them in two ways. Simply, the law and the prophets. That's the normal one you'll see. The law and the prophets. You might say, what about the wisdom literature? The wisdom literature was included in the category of the prophets. So basically, the word law, a Greek nomos translating Torah, is referring to the five books of Moses. And then the category of the prophets means basically everything else, which would include things like Isaiah, Jeremiah, but also the Book of Psalms and the Book of Proverbs. So when you hear in the New Testament, when Jesus says the commandments, two commandments fill all the law, law and the prophets. Love God and your neighbor as yourself. He's referring to the fulfilling of the law and the prophets. He's referring to all of the Hebrew scriptures that would include also the Psalms and the Book of Proverbs. Again, if it's not in the five books of Moses, they threw it into the category of the prophets. Prophet, we often think of something, you know, that foretells the future. But that's not a biblical way of understanding the word prophecy or prophets. Prophecy is enunciating God's word. Prophet is someone who enunciates God's word. That's how it's used in the scriptures. Often it has a future reference, but that's not the primary purpose of it. Okay, so the law and the prophets. When you get into something like Luke's gospel, you'll hear a little further distinction. You'll get law, the prophets, and the Psalms. Because the Psalms is really its own category. It's a hymnal. It's the hymnal of the temple collected over a long period of time. And so the Book of Psalms will sometimes be set apart on its own. So the law, the prophets, and the Psalms. So you have the law, five books of Moses, the Psalms, the five scrolls of the Psalms and the Book of Psalms. And then you've got the prophets, which would include basically everything in between. Okay. All right. So internal record of composition. So if you look at these references, we're not going to look at these tonight. We don't have time to do this. So I have here pulled up for you on the screen a number of references, Exodus 17, 14, Exodus 24, 4, Numbers 33, 2, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Places where we hear God commanding or a reference to a character writing down God's word. Okay, so that is places where God commands them to write something down, or we have a record of them writing something down. So you can hear an internal references to they were writing stuff down. Okay, and then that's the Old Testament. So the Old Testament comes to us in various forms. We'll get to that in a second. So that's not the end of the Old Testament discussion. It's much more complex, but there's just the general information. New Testament. Of course, the epistles of Paul, the first of the compositions of what we call the New Testament, the epistle of Paul written from the 40s to 60s, somewhere in there. The Catholic epistles, that is the universal epistles, are written to more broad audiences than the Pauline epistles. So they refer to as Catholic, that is having a more general audience. And that would be like, you know, James and Jude and 1st and 2nd Peter. The Synoptic Gospels and Acts, written sometime between 50s to the 70s, depending on how you want to date these things. And then the Johannine literature, the Gospel of John, the three epistles of John, the Book of Revelation, written sometime from the 80s to 100. Most scholars would date them to right around 95, 90 to 95, which I think makes a lot of sense. Okay, so now the beginning of a canon. So where do we get this list of books, or which books go in my Bible, and that idea? Where does that come from? So the beginning of a canon, measurement, a list of books. The first hints at this we find in the New Testament with the debates between the Sadducees and the Samaritans and the Pharisees, etc. The Sadducees accepted only the five books of Moses as canonical or inspired. Okay, so Sadducees. So the Sadducees were a particular sect of the Jews in the first century. They primarily controlled the Levitical priesthood, the temple. If you were a Levite, if you were a priest in the first century, you probably belonged to the sect of the Sadducees. And for them, the five books of Moses, that was it. After that, it was kind of, you know, every man for himself. But the five books of Moses, they agreed were certainly inspired and authoritative. After that, interesting stuff for them. Okay, so, and then there's some references I give you, Matthew 22, verse 23 and 34, Acts 4, Acts 5. These are places that you find the Sadducees, this hint at this smaller canon they have. If you'll look at the New Testament, whenever Jesus is talking to a Sadducee, he is quoting from the five books of Moses. They quote from the five books of Moses, and he quotes back from the five books of Moses. The Sadducees never quote from the Psalms or the prophets, and Jesus won't either when he's talking to a Sadducee, because they don't accept anything but the five books of Moses. And so if he's arguing with the Sadducee and he quotes from Isaiah, they're going to say, out of bounds, you Pharisee. So they aren't going to accept his argument. Okay, so the Sadducees, five books of Moses. The Samaritans only accepted their version of the Torah. So they were like Sadducees in some ways, as far as their canon went, but they had their own version of it. It's called the Samaritan Pentateuch. It's the Pentateuch with a few little minor changes to it. Wherever it refers to God causing his name to dwell in a place, they'll always throw in Mount Gerizim, because that's the northern region where the Samaritans were and where they tried to establish their particular sect, and Mount Gerizim being the place where they eventually built a temple in opposition to the temple in Jerusalem that the Jews would not let them help rebuild after the Babylonian exile. So that's the Samaritans. So the Samaritans had the five books of Moses, but a slightly skewed form of it, but 99% of it's identical. So they have all the kosher laws. Most people don't know this, but the Samaritans kept kosher. They no ham, no bacon. They circumcised their boys. Okay, they kept the same basic laws the Sadducee would keep. The Samaritans dwelt in the northern region, of course. Samaritans from Samaria, from the northern kingdom. That has a long history to it. The northern region that broke off from the southern region during the time of Rehoboam, after Solomon had died. Remember, there's the northern and southern kingdoms, the kingdom of Israel in the north, kingdom of Judah in the south. The kingdom of Israel in the north built a capital city on the mountain of Shamar, and eventually became known as Samaria or Samaria. More on that in another discussion. Okay, so the Pharisees accepted the Torah, of course, and the rest. So everything else. So the Pharisees, a huge difference between the Sadducees and Pharisees in the first century, these two different groups of Jews, different denominations, was the Pharisees accepted the five books of Moses as inspired, of course, and most authoritative. But they also believed that the Psalms, the prophets, the book of Proverbs, the wisdom literature, all this stuff was inspired. They believed that all in some way God was speaking to them through it. So the Pharisees, and these are references, you'll hear Jesus quote, when he's talking about Pharisee, he'll quote from the Psalms, he'll quote from Isaiah when he's debating with a Pharisee. That shows you, again, what was going on. You're talking to a Pharisee, now the boundary's a little wider. So when they quote, they'll quote from not only the Torah, but the Psalms and the prophets. And when Jesus responds to them, he'll quote from not only the Torah, but also the Psalms and the prophets and the wisdom literature. Okay. All right. So the Pharisees, another sect of the Jews, had a much broader canon. It's basically the canon of the Pharisees that we end up with as Christians, as far as our Old Testament go. But it comes to us through the Septuagint. So Septuagint, what is the Septuagint? Abbreviated LXX from the Latin numerals. Septuagint from the Latin Septuaginta, meaning 70. The name comes from the story that it was translated by 70 rabbis in Alexandria at the request of Ptolemy II, 285 to 247 BC. It is a Greek translation of the Old Testament, assembled over a period most likely between 250 to 150 BC, and was in use in Palestine by the time of Christ. It was thus also used by the New Testament authors in their Greek quotations of the Old Testament. The canon of the Septuagint was, with little difference, that which was used and eventually accepted in the early church. So the list, the books that are in the Septuagint. So the Septuagint is one of those, it's a story that is just not well known today, but really needs to be better known. If you look at the New Testament quotations of the Old Testament, and there are a lot of them, they are quotations from the Septuagint. So as Christians, we need to be much more aware of this Septuagint text. It came about out of, as a result of need. The Jews, by the time we get to the time of Jesus, are spread all over the Mediterranean area. And they have synagogues. A synagogue is a local neighborhood house building in which the local Jews gather and sing some psalms on the Sabbath, hear a reading from the Torah, from the prophets, sing some more psalms, and then we'll hear maybe a explanation, a sermon, a homily from the synagogue leader. Sing some more psalms and go home. The Sabbath. Okay, that was there. If you had a decent sized population of Jews in a city or a town, they'd have a synagogue. As you're reading Paul's travels in Acts of the Apostles, you'll hear he'll go to a certain place, Thessaloniki or wherever, and he'll look and wait and find if he can find a synagogue, because on the Saturday, that's where the Jews are going to gather and he can preach the gospel to them. They were waiting for the Messiah. When he comes to Philippi, there was no synagogue. There weren't enough Jews in the city. So if you read in Acts, you can kind of get a sense of that, of how that works. But okay, so these Jews throughout the diaspora from Alexandria, throughout northern Africa, the congregation of Jews in Rome, in Spain, in Syria, in Palestine, all over. The language that connected them all, wherever they were, Athens, Corinth, Thessaloniki, all these places you hear Paul traveling to, all those Jews spoke Greek. Greek was their language. They didn't speak Hebrew. Hebrew was a dead language among the Jews centuries earlier. This is why the Septuagint comes about. In fact, in between the Septuagint and Hebrew is Aramaic. The Jews were speaking Hebrew in their early history, which is why their scriptures are written down in Hebrew, so the people can understand what is being written down, of course. Perfectly logical. As the Jews slowly transitioned from speaking Hebrew to Aramaic, this is during the time of the Assyrian Empire and early Babylonian Empire, Hebrew is starting to fall away and Aramaic is coming in as a dominant language. They're sister languages, but they're different. Well, that's when you start seeing the scriptures of Israel being written in Aramaic. Why would they do that? Well, because if someone's going to write something down, they're going to want someone to read it, right? Can you imagine writing a book in a language that nobody understands? So you're going to write, you want to write down what you feel people need to know in a language they understand. So you start to see then the Hebrew scripture being written in Aramaic, not Hebrew anymore. This is like the book of Daniel, the book of Ezra. Daniel is all Aramaic. It's not Hebrew. Ezra is a conglomerate text. Some chapters are Hebrew, some are in Aramaic, which means it probably is a conglomeration of two different manuscript families, a Hebrew version of Ezra and an Aramaic version of Ezra. And then the final form we get of the book as we have it is actually piecemeal. It's got a chapter or two in Hebrew, a chapter or two in Aramaic. When you look at something like Esther, it's Spanglish. It's a mixture of Hebrew and Aramaic. It's a transit. It's called late Hebrew, but it's not Hebrew. It's Hebrew Aramaic. And the only way you can read Esther is if you've studied both languages. So you're seeing there that at that point, as the people are speaking, as they're transitioning out of Hebrew and Aramaic, their scriptures are being written. Their religious scriptures are written in the language that they are speaking for obvious reasons. As they're transitioning then into Greek in the latter period, just before the time of Christ, you start to see their books in Greek. So for example, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th Maccabees are composed in Greek. The Book of Wisdom is written in Greek. The Book of Sirach, though it may have originally been in Hebrew Aramaic, the form we have it, is in Greek. So the books are written, are starting to be composed then in that latter period in Greek, in the language of the Jews of the period. Okay, so then when we come to this time of the coming of Christ, the Christian era, the Jews have a little bit of a complexity of their scriptures. They have, of course, debates about what books are inspired, but they also have books that are written in different languages. Early ones written in Hebrew, middle ones written in Aramaic, late ones written in Greek. Well, by the time you get to the Christian era, the vast majority of Jews now are no longer speaking Hebrew or Aramaic, but only Greek. So what happens is they start translating the Hebrew books and the Aramaic books into Greek. And the Hebrew books and the Aramaic books that are translated into Greek are joined to the books that were already composed in Greek, like 1st and 2nd, 3rd, 4th Maccabees, things. And that collection of Greek scriptures eventually put into a scroll is then what you find in the synagogues all throughout the Mediterranean. That scroll or that collection of books is called the Septuagint, which has a story behind it that 70 rabbis translate on 70 days with 70 pens on 70 whatever. It's an interesting story, but most likely, as far as we can tell, this is a collection over multiple decades, maybe a century's period or more, of various books that are translated from Hebrew into Greek, Aramaic into Greek, and then joined with other books that are in Greek, composed in Greek, and those become what are used in the synagogues throughout the entire Mediterranean, including in Jerusalem. In Jerusalem, Stephen, look at his name, Stephanos, it's a Greek name. Look at Jesus' apostles, Andrew, Andreos, Philippos, Philip. So these individuals, they have Greek names. Greek is saturating the Jewish world. Where do Jews go on Saturday? What do we call it? Synagogue? That's a Greek word. Synagoge. That's a Greek word. It's not Hebrew. It's not Aramaic. It's Greek. Greek is part of the world and history of Judaism. Okay, so the Septuagint is part of that Greek world of Judaism. And it's from the Septuagint, this collection of Greek versions of the Jewish scriptures that the New Testament authors quote. No surprise. If you're going to quote in Greek, if you're writing in Greek, you're going to quote in Greek, and you're going to quote in Greek from an accepted, well-known text that you already have in your head and that everybody accepts as a good translation. So that's what you find. As you read the New Testament, you find quotations of the Old Testament are drawn, for the most part, from what's called the Septuagint, the Greek form of the Old Testament. Now, the Old Testament has a little more history to it, and that is the Council of Yamnia. Council with a question mark. Better be called maybe school or period of Yamnia. Yamnia is a city on the northern coast of Palestine, and it's a place where the Jews gathered after the destruction of Jerusalem, AD 70. Cataclysmic event. Jerusalem's destroyed. The temple's destroyed, AD 70. Jews were not allowed by Roman law to be within sight of the city. One of the places some of the Jews hung out was the city of Yamnia. And there, some of their rabbis started to gather and started to try to make sense out of their situation from a religious and political standpoint. That period from 90 to 100 AD is called, for lack of a better term, the Council of Yamnia. Don't think they sat around at some round table and made some decisions with some voting, though. It's not like that. It's the school of Yamnia, you could call it, or the period of Yamnia. From Yamnia and from the rabbis that gathered there, who were considered to be authoritative by others in other villages and cities, having a lot of influence, comes then what's known as the Canon of Yamnia, for, again, lack of a better term. It is a smaller canon. It is the canon of the scriptures of the Old Testament the Jews currently have. It's kind of, in many ways, the beginning of what's known as Rabbinic Judaism or modern Judaism. And what did they they rejected from what could be read in the synagogues. First and second Maccabees, also third and fourth Maccabees as well, of course. Tobit, Judith, Sirach, Wisdom, Baruch, parts of Daniel and Esther. Now, though they may have been more acceptance of what was sure to them than rejection. Okay, so when we hear about this happening, we often think of it in a reactionary way. They're throwing out our scriptures. Okay, let's look at it historically. The books that they ended up not accepting for use in the synagogues are books that they actually still hold in serious reverence and as important today. But they just don't read them in the synagogue. They just have two different tiers of authority there. And what they did is they basically, these are books that are written in Greek or that were available to them in Greek. So what they're doing in the 90s to 100s, they're reacting. They're going back into the foxhole. What do we know is safe? What do we know is good and old? What did great-grandma read? What did they read in the synagogue during great-grandma's time? And that's what happens. And so the newer books, which also are those written in Greek due to history, are the books that don't make it into the synagogue lectionary. And that then is known to most Christians due to Martin Luther. So this is the canon that has continued in use among the Jews ever since and was eventually adopted by Martin Luther, in his German translation, where he also rejected from the New Testament as inspired Hebrews, James, 2 Peter, 2nd, 3rd John, Jude, and Revelation. Most people don't know about that. Luther rejected not only certain books from the Old Testament. When he was asking the local Jews in Germany, what books do you have in your Bible? He found that they were short, some books. So he said, well, wait a minute. Those are the ones, that's what we're going to go with. And then But then he also dumped seven books out of the New Testament. Now you must really. I mean, how come? Modern Protestantism has nothing to do with Luther. Very little to do with Luther. Modern Lutheranism has very little to do with Luther. A modern Lutheran Bible has all the books in it should have for the New Testament. But Luther, in his original revolution, rejected these books. He said they were interesting reading, possibly, but the Epistle of James, for example, he said it's an epistle of straw. That is, it's worthy only to be bound up like straw and burned in the fire to keep you warm. So that's Luther's vision of the Epistle of James, okay? This is why Protestants today even somewhat hesitant about the book. So, but there are a number of books that he rejects, not only from the old, but from the new. There's a lot of theological issues there behind it, what guided him and why he did those things. But tonight we're not going to be talking so much about Luther and some of his craziness. All right, so now, aside from Luther, and aside from these issues of these different groups of the Sadducees, the Pharisees, and the Septuagint, how do we get to the books we have today? Well, I have here listed for you 46 Old Testament books, 27 New Testament books, which is pretty much the standard. And those lists of 46 Old Testament and 27 New Testament books can be found in the writings of St. Athanasius, Cyril of Jerusalem, the Declaration of the Council of Hippo, and the Council of Carthage. Now, what's going on there? Why are they all? Look at those dates. And in fact, Athanasius from Alexandria, Council of Hippo, North Africa, Council of Carthage, North Africa, Jerusalem, not too far away. Okay, so what's going on there? Well, what's happening at that period is in Northern Africa, Gnostic Christianity is starting to really take hold. Gnostic Christianity is a heretical form of Christianity that, for the most part, has died out, although some of the hints or the themes of it still you'll see it occasionally today, but basically it's died out. And they had their own forms of the scriptures. They had their own books. They had, for example, they composed books like what's known as the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Peter. These books have nothing to do with Peter or Thomas the Apostle. Any historian will tell you that. They have nothing to do with the apostolic era. They're composed somewhere around 250 to 300. And this is when Gnostic Christianity is really taking off in North Africa. Well, by the time you get to St. Athanasius, the Council of Carthage, the Council of Hippo, these Gnostic sects with their Gnostic scriptures and their Gnostic forms of Christian scriptures are starting to infect and influence Orthodox Christianity in North Africa. And so the bishops, the councils, have to start coming down on it saying, okay, no, you're not going to read that in your church. No. The only book we allow to be read in our churches. So St. Athanasius, Patriarch of Alexandria at this point, has to say, the books that we allow to be read in the church during the Divine Liturgy are as follows. And he lists 46 books of the Old Testament and the 27 of the New. Everything else, he says, is not to be read during the Divine Liturgy. The Council of Carthage, the Council of Hippo, same thing going on. These are bishops gathering in those cities in North Africa who are starting to feel some influences from the Gnostic sects coming into their congregations, influencing them, and some of their priests starting to read some of these books like the Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Peter. And so the local bishops of Carthage, the bishops of Hippo, gathered together and pronounced and said, no, the only books we read in the liturgy are as follows. And they list the 47 books of the Old Testament, the 27 books of the New Testament, probably following the declaration of Athanasius. Cyril of Jerusalem, likewise, not far from North Africa, does the same thing. Jerusalem is not far from North Africa, so you're going to have some Gnostic influences coming in there as well. Okay, so what's important to understand there, before we move on to English translations, or from there until where we get to the modern English translations, a few other things in between, is to understand that St. Athanasius, Cyril of Jerusalem, Council of Hippo, Council of Carthage are not declaring what is to be in the Bible. a lot of times people will think of it that way. Ah, they declared what should be in our Bible. No, they're enunciating what has been the tradition in their local church. They're passing on the tradition authoritatively. Councils don't create tradition if they're an Orthodox council. They pass on authentically the tradition. St. Athanasius was passing on what he understood to be the proper list of books to be read in the lectionary. Cyril Jerusalem was passing on, the Council of Philip, Council of Carthage, they were passing on what the local bishops gathered together and understood and believed to have been received from those who were before them. And that's why those declarations are important, because they're an enunciation of a tradition that preceded them. You see how that works? Okay. All right. Now, what comes next? All right. So now, a short history of major translations in English. Well, that's a huge jump. It is a huge jump. And there's a little bit of a segue here that we're going to need, and that is the Vulgate. So in order to understand how we get to our modern English translations from everything we were just talking about, we have to discuss briefly the Vulgate. So I have here for you, let me pull it up now. Let's see here. Let's see if I can do this. Let's see, stop sharing this one. And I'm going to reshare here. I never forgot how to do this smoothly. Okay, the Vulgate. All right, so the Vulgate. The Vulgate is Biblia Vulgata, for Latin. Put in English, the Vulgar Bible, but don't read it that way. The way in which it would be understood by the people, the vulgar, or that is common, okay? The way that the commoner could understand it. The thing, this translation begins with Pope Damasus. But before Pope Damasus and Jerome, there's a pre-translation, and that is called the Vetus Latina. The Vetus Latina is, that is the Old Latin, meaning before Jerome, is a collection of translations of disparate origins from disparate regions, and times and everything and qualities of the Greek scriptures for liturgical use in the Latin churches. So originally in, let's say, the church in Rome or in Spain or wherever, in the first couple centuries, everything was in Greek. Because remember, the Jews spoke Greek, and the Jews are the in their synagogues are the places where Christianity first takes hold in all these cities. And Greek was the common language of trade. So even all the way to Spain, all across North Africa, before the Roman Empire, the Greek Empire was there. And so you've got, and even places where the Greek Empire didn't politically control, you still had influence of the Greek marketeers and the Greek language. And so what happens is that Greek is a dominant language. It's the lingua franca. It's the language of the people, to use a modern term, the language of the people all over the Mediterranean. It's the common language that unites. It's what English is today. What English is today in the world, Greek was in the first century, in the first couple centuries. Okay, so when Paul wrote his letter to the church in Rome, the letter to the Romans, he wrote in Greek. He said, why didn't he write in Latin? His Latin probably wasn't all that great, if you even knew Latin. But if he had written in Latin, only people in Rome who spoke Italian, Italica, right, the language of that region, could understand it. But the church in Rome reflected the city of Rome, which had a vast majority of people from different regions, and what united them all was they could all speak Greek. It's surprising, I think, to a lot of people to find out that in Rome, Greek was considered to be the educated language. So when they got together for a little cocktail party, the aristocracy, they talked in Greek. Speaking Latin was considered to be, well, that's the commoner speech, the local language, but Greek was the educated language. The Romans were enamored with the Greek world. It was very, very popular in Rome to hire a Greek servant or buy a Greek slave for the household, because then they could teach your kids Greek. Okay, so this is how Greek is all over the place, in even in the city of Rome. So Paul can write his letter to the church in Rome and expect they're going to be able to understand it. The church in Rome, its liturgy, as far as we can discern for the first at least two centuries, was all in Greek. However, slowly as the language of the people starts to transition, as Greek starts to fade away, as the Roman Empire becomes its own thing, and Latin in the West, especially in Europe, as it's conquering, you know, all the way into the North, is now moving into areas that the Greek Empire never was, Latin starts to take a dominance. And so now, as Greek is falling out of use, even in the city of Rome and all over Italica, Italy, and North Africa, and Latin is beginning to become a more well-known language than Greek, then seamlessly, organically, all over the Roman Empire in the Western world, the Bible started to be translated for liturgical use, and the liturgy itself as well, into Latin. Why? Because this is what the people spoke. You can't pray in a language they don't understand. You can't read the scriptures in a language they understand. Otherwise, what are you doing? You're just cutting them off. Doesn't make any sense. Completely foreign to the history of the Judeo-Christian tradition. So they would translate organically. And so from one church and this parish and that parish, whoever knew a little, as St. Augustine says, St. Augustine, ripping his hair out over the chaos at the time, says, it's as if everybody who thinks he knows a little bit of Greek and Latin makes his own translation. And it was true. Every little parish had its own translation. This vast pile of translations of the Greek scriptures, Old and New Testament, into Latin at local levels is called the Vetus Latina, singular, but it's really a pile of various translations of things. The Vetus Latina Italica, that is the ones that were made in Italy, were considered to be some of the best, and rightly so, because that's where people spoke Latin the best, right? This is where it was spoken. You know, you go to North Africa or Spain, they're speaking, you know, pig Latin, okay? Not pig Latin, but pigeon Latin, okay? So they're not speaking good Latin, but in Italica, in Italy, they're speaking good Latin. So you're going to get good Latin translations. The Latin will sound good, not necessarily the best translation, but certainly good Latin, right? So Pope Damasus comes on the scene and realizes that there is a major crisis in the West, and that is that there are all of these parishes in his region are translating everything into Latin, and it's total chaos. The Psalms, the Gospels, the Epistle book, everything in the liturgy itself is all being chaotically translated by people of various education levels. So he decided to hire Jerome. Jerome was a great scholar of the time. He was considered to be a great scholar because he knew Greek. There weren't a lot of great people at the time who could still speak Greek in the West. And so Jerome knew Greek well. And so he was hired by Pope Damasus to make a good, authoritative, reliable Latin translation for the people and for the parishes. And so that begins what's called the Latin Vulgate. His first attempt at that, the beginning of the thing, is with the four Gospels, right? It's the most, if you think of the liturgy, what's the most important part of the scriptures usage? And well, it's the four Gospels. So he made a Gospel book. And we don't have time to read all this. We're out of time. You can look this up on your own on the internet. Posted here for you, the letter of Jerome to Pope Damasus. It's quite humorous. I'll just summarize it for you. He basically says, Pope Damasus, You sent me a letter asking me to make a translation of the Bible in Latin for, you know, a good translation. I didn't want to do it because I didn't want people to kill me. Because if I start translating the Bible from Greek into Latin and it doesn't match up with what people are used to, they're going to call me a heretic. And then they're going to try and kill me. But because you are the Bishop of Rome and with your authority and your blessing, I decided to go ahead and do it anyway. So I made first a translation of the four Gospels, the most important part of the scriptures for liturgical use. I used first our form, that is the Italica form of the Vetus Latina, the four Gospels, which has good Latin, not necessarily the best translation. He said, so I used that first as my guide, and I compared it to the Greek. And I only fixed spots where I absolutely had to, where the Latin translation was absolutely erroneous. I fixed those spots. Other spots where I'd like to have changed things, but it wasn't critical. I stayed my hand, lest I make too many changes and people try to kill me. Loving kisses, Jerome, to Pope Damasus. That was it. Okay, I'm giving you a little summary of the whole thing. You can read on your own. All right, it's very educational about the history of the thing. So then eventually he starts work on the epistle book, and then he starts work on the Psalms. He makes three attempts at the Psalms. He first tried to fix up the Vetus Latina version of the Psalms, Italica, and that version eventually was accepted in Rome. Pope Damasus was still alive at the time, and it became known as the Roman Psalter. He then said, nah, that thing's just garbage. I'm going to start over. So he makes a fresh translation from the Greek, Septuagint, form of the Psalms, into Latin again. This is his own composition now, his own translation. That was not accepted in Rome because they're not going to accept a new translation. They already got one, a new one from there. So it got accepted in Gaul, in the churches of Gaul. It's called the Gallican Psalter. Both are in use in various ways in the traditional Latin liturgy. Then he said, that was no good either. I'm starting fresh. By now he's studying Hebrew and he's in Bethlehem. So he made a fresh translation directly from the Hebrew into Latin. And that's probably by far his most valuable translation, but no one ever accepted it because by then no one wants to keep changing their scriptures. Okay, these are liturgical purposes. People are trying to memorize these things and sing them. So it never got accepted anywhere for liturgical use. All right, so and then eventually he kept working on the rest. And so what became known as the Vulgate is actually not all Jerome's. Some of it is spots where he took the Vetus Latina and fixed it, like the Gospels. Some places you actually have fresh translations by Jerome from the Greek. Some places you have fresh translations by Jerome from the Hebrew, like the book of Genesis. And then some places he just had stuff. He said, you know what? This is good enough. The Vetus Latina is just fine. He left it. And the conglomeration of all of those Latin texts that Jerome had either fixed or accepted or completely retranslated becomes known as the Latin Vulgate, which again is a pile of different books of various origins and relationships to Jerome, but eventually gets the stamp Jerome on it. Okay, so that's by the way, if you ever want to read more about this, there's a wonderful, very exhaustive discussion of this in the Old Catholic Encyclopedia on the Vulgate. You go pick up the Old Catholic Encyclopedia on the Vulgate and also the new one. Both have excellent, exhaustive articles on the history of the Vulgate, basically of what I just gave you in summary. Okay, now, with that in mind, now let's go over to back to the other text. Are you able to see now, did this switch over for you, short history of the major translation to English? Didn't switch over. Someone's going to have to school me on how Zoom works. Let me stop sharing back to that now. Okay, can you see it now? Adam, can you see that short history? No, still, what happened? All right, let me try it again. It takes a while. That worked? Okay, good. I'm getting some thumbs up. I need some more education in Zoom. Okay, so short history of major translation English. You cannot discuss this without referring to the Vulgate. The English translations are in their history originate from the Vulgate. Okay, so we just talked about the Vulgate and its brief history. All right, so now, or its long history, actually. So the English translations, which everyone's interested in, this is the Bible I'm reading, in English. Okay, so I have here on the title, short history. First of all, it's way more complicated than this. Of the major, so there's way more than this. These are just the major ones. Translations, note translations here, translations of the Bible. These are not the Bible themselves, right? In English. So the conversation we're about to have, be aware, is a very American conversation, okay? A lot of people, it's so funny, English, you know, English-speaking Americans, they'll think that somehow, oh, yeah, well, don't they use the King James? Didn't Luther use the King James, you know? I mean, why would he use the King James? Or you'll get Roman Catholics. Doesn't the Pope use the Douay Rheims? No, they in Rome, they have no idea what the Douay Rheims actually is. Probably not, most have never even heard of it in Italy, okay? It's in English. What? Okay, so we Americans, we often have our cultural blinders on. But so be aware, this is a short history of the major translations in English. Okay, this is a very, very narrow conversation. Though for us Americans, we often would think this, well, this doesn't cover everything. Okay, so first of all, in English, the two major sources of English translations come from two main roots. And again, it's way more complicated than this, but this is the basics. The English Roman Catholic translation history into English is this. Primarily, we have the Douay Rheims, which is from a collection of some Vulgate manuscripts in France. Okay, so that's first of all to note. Most people who read the Douay Rheims think that somehow it's a it, in fact, it's funny. You'll sometimes hear people think that the Douay Rheims is actually Jerome's text. I've come upon this occasionally. Okay, so the Douay Rheims is an English translation of the Vulgate. And I don't want to say the word Jerome here, because the Vulgate, by the time we get to that period, is actually a conglomerate text of various histories. Okay, so, but it's also, people should note that it's of French manuscripts. So Vulgate manuscripts, they're only in France at the time. There are various other forms of Vulgate manuscripts that are in Italy and Spain and other places that have variations to them. And if we have a few seconds at the end, I'll maybe show you an example of that. It's quite interesting. So be aware that the Vulgate manuscripts are not some sort of, you know, all identical text. They're manuscript families. There are French Vulgate manuscript families. There are Italian. There are Spanish. There are North African. There are Gallican Vulgate families of manuscripts with huge variations among them. The manuscripts that were at hand in the cities of Reims and Douai in France were the source of the original Douay Rheims. Okay, so the Douay Rheims is a representation of Vulgate manuscripts that were in France, not of the Vulgate manuscripts of the world. Okay, very important to understand that. Huge variations among them as well. Again, if I have time, I'll show you some examples of that. Okay, so where did it come from? Well, the Douay Rheims is when the Catholics had to flee from England, they fled across the channel into France. And in the city of Reims, 1582, and the city of Douai in 1609, they translated the New Testament, Old Testament, respectively, and that became known as the Douay Rheims, the Douay Rheims Bible. Now, we have to jump over to the English Protestant side to keep our history straight here. Not too long after that, the English made the Anglicans made their own Bible from the Masoretic text of the Old Testament, though that's what they say they did. I guarantee they were not using Hebrew. They were using the Septuagint. And Erasmus's Greek New Testament, known by then as the Textus Receptus, the received text from the apostles. It's nothing to do with that, but that's what they called it. So the Erasmus was a scholar, Northern European scholar of the time, a Renaissance man, who not only knew Latin, but he also knew Greek. And you know, you can't find that many guys that know Greek at this time. So he knew Greek. He was known to be a classicist. He had studied classical Greek and classical Latin. And so he was hired to make a good Greek text from which translations could be made. That eventually, over multiple editions, that text he produced, which was not all that great. He used a couple of different manuscripts that were fairly late, 8th, 9th century manuscripts, created a base text. One, he took these two manuscripts, and then were in spots where he didn't like what he was reading, he just fixed it and composed in the holes that he perceived his own Greek text. And so Erasmus's text is the basically two very late manuscripts, 8th, 9th century Greek manuscripts of not very great quality, with Erasmus's own memory of the Vulgate translating back into Greek, into spots where he likes to fix things. And then that text he created was used by many people to make translations. Eventually, the British got a hold of it after multiple editions later, and they made their own translation from that text. It had problems immediately because the English text that came out in 1611, while it might have been really nice English, although it was just the commoners' English at the time, was based upon a faulty Greek text. Immediately, people revolted. The Anglicans revolted. They hated the thing. In fact, they hated it so much that they started reprinting the Douay Rheims in England. The Anglicans started doing it because it was better. It was a better text, more acceptable to what they knew. The 1611 used, they say, the Masoretic, that is the Hebrew text they had available to them for the Old Testament. I highly doubt that, but let's say they played around a little bit. And they used Erasmus's New Testament. And then they used the Douay Rheims, which was already floating around in Catholic communities in England, as a guide. In fact, they actually say it in the, if you read the 1611 introduction, it says, we have compared this diligently to the papist text and found it to be superior. Well, so they were using it. And any King James scholar, that is a scholar who studies the King James history of translation of the text, will tell you that. It's got a lot of Douay Rheimsisms in it. But it's still got problems. Okay, so that was the 1611 King James. No one walking around today with a King James Bible has the 1611. I have one on my shelf, but for the most part, nobody has 1611. You can't even read it. It's not modern English. We'll get to the later translation in a second. Now we're going to jump over to the other side of the column here. You all can see this, these two columns? Everyone see this, the two columns? Okay. All right, so now we're going to jump over historically now to 1751. By the time we get to 1751, the Douay Rheims is, while still considered authoritative in the English-speaking Catholic world in England, it is no longer comprehensible English. English was changing dramatically at this point. And so what they had to do was make a revision of it. It was also learned by then that there were a number of problems with the French manuscripts that they had used for their translation. So Bishop Chandler made a revision of the Douay Rheims in 1751. His main three sources from which he worked were the original Douay Rheims as his guide, the King James 1611, and more Latin manuscripts that had been discovered of the Vulgate since then. By now, at this point, the West is searching diligently for more and more Latin manuscripts and trying to create a good Latin authoritative text. Okay, so Chandler's revision is a product of that. He's using the old Douay Rheims as his main base text. He's fixing it up by comparing it to the King James 1611. And he is using as a guide also for his revisions the more recently discovered Latin Vulgate manuscripts from various other regions, monasteries and things like that throughout Rome and Spain and other places besides just France. Chandler's revision was rejected originally at a popular level. It was rejected because it was considered to be a ripoff of the King James 1611. It had so many King James-isms in it that the Catholics recognized them and said, hey, this is heresy. This thing is simply taking the King James Bible and mixing it in a blender with our old Douay Rheims. That sham revision is what most people have when they pick up a Douay Rheims today. So if anyone listening in today has a King James, a Douay Rheims Bible, says, I like the old Douay Rheims. Okay, well, what you've got there in your hand is actually a 1751 revision of the original Douay Rheims with a lot of King James 1611 influence in it, which is okay. I'm fine with that. But it's so funny how people often get, you know, my Douay Rheims fell out of the sky, or the Protestant, my King James fell out of the sky. But they don't understand the history of where these things come from and how actually related the Catholic and Protestant translations of the King James Douay Rheims are interrelated here. They're interbreeding at this point. You've got the Douay Rheims influence 1611, the 1611 influence the Chandler revision. And then let's jump over to the other side now. Then in 1885, the King James Bible, also known as the Authorized Version, was revised. What did they use? Well, they used the 1614 or some, one of the later editions, as their base text. And then they used Chandler's revision as a guide to fix it up. That's the Authorized Version, 1885. And by now, there's a lot of Greek studies being done. Lots of Greek manuscripts are being discovered. And so they're using those as a guide and things like that. That's the 1885 King James. That is today what most people call the King James. So if someone walks up and says, I got a King James Bible. It's the word of God dropped right out of the sky. It came from St. Paul. Good enough for St. Paul. Good enough for me. Well, what they've got in their hand is an 1885 King James Bible. They don't have the 1611. And it has been influenced by two different Catholic translations so far now, the original Douay Rheims and the Chandler revision. It's a good text. The King James Bible that most people walk around with today, that 1885, is a pretty good text. It's old English. It's dated English. Most people today couldn't understand it, at least some portions of it. But it's a pretty good text. It's got some problems in its history and things that it didn't ever, fix. But for the most part, it's, 95% all right. Okay. Now, then jump back over to the Catholic side. Then we have the Kenrick revision of the Douay Rheims. So now you have another revision, 1899, of the Douay Rheims Bible. Again, if you've got a Douay Rheims anywhere on your shelf, you want to pick it up maybe and look in the cover and see what you've got there in your hand. You've got probably a Kenrick or a Chandler revision. The Kenrick revision, 1899. Okay, and then let's jump back over to the Protestant side, become the American Standard Version. So the King James Bible was then, edited, fixed up for an American English-speaking audience in 1901. That has become known as the Authorized Standard Version. So if you have an ASV on your shelf, I've got one. That is the American version of the King James. It's a very good text, actually. It's very stilted English. It became, because it was, they used the King James as their base text. They cleaned up the English a little bit. It's still got a lot of the old forms in there, but they cleaned up a little bit. But what they did is, by now there's massive amounts of Greek studies going on and manuscript studies in Greek. And so they're fixing the King James, 1885, based upon the various new discoveries of Greek manuscripts. It's a pretty good text. In fact, it was so popular, it became the favorite of Protestant preachers in America for them to use in their pulpit. Because it was kind of like a little cheater book. They don't know Greek, so what are they going to do? Well, this American Standard Version is a very stilted English text because they're trying to follow the wording, even the word order of Greek as best as they can. American Standard Version. This is, by the way, one of the main texts that's behind the Jehovah's Witness New World Translation, which is neither new nor world nor translation, but that's for another conversation. Okay, so the Jehovah's Witness New World Translation, major problems, nothing to do with the Bible itself, but they ripped off the American Standard Version and created their own text, which is just an American Standard Version with their own little doctrinal changes they made. Okay, but that's not going to be discussed in the history of English translation because it has nothing to do with English translation of the Bible. But all right, now we're going to pop back over to the Catholic side. In 1950, the English-speaking Catholics decided there was time to make a new translation. Based upon all the discoveries with Latin and the Vulgate manuscripts, all the discoveries of all the Greek manuscripts by now, and all the great studies of Hebrew and Greek and Aramaic and Catholic universities and things, I think of Catholic University in Washington, D.C. So they produced what was called the Confraternity New Testament. The Confraternity of Christian Doctrine produced this New Testament. So it became known as, for lack of a better term, the Confraternity New Testament. They used the Douay Rheims, the current one at the time, Kenrick, as a guide, as their base text. But they were free to fix it up. So it, in many places, looks nothing like the Douay Rheims. They've also modernized the English there. So where they could leave it, they'd leave it as the Douay Rheims text, but fix the English. But where they felt there was a need to fix it textually, they just fixed it. So the Confraternity, in many ways, is really a new translation. It certainly has the Douay Rheims as its, ancestor, because all these guys working on this grew up hearing the Douay Rheims. So that's going to guide the way they're going to make their translation. But they also, when they went to translate, they were translating freshly in many places from the Greek or Latin manuscripts they had available to them. And that became known as the Confraternity New Testament. They were planning to work on the Old Testament. They never finished it. So when you find a Confraternity Bible, you're going to typically, it's going to be a New Testament only, or it'll be a New Testament Confraternity, and the printers, needing something to print, would stick the Kenrick or Chandler Old Testament as the Old Testament section. So if you have a complete Old and New Testament Bible that says Confraternity, it's a Confraternity New Testament, and the Old Testament is either Kenrick or Chandler Douay Rheims revision. What stopped them from finishing the Old Testament? Well, look at that date. Right, what's coming here? So when they began to make preparations for the Second Vatican Council, they knew that they might want to just put this thing on hold because who knows what's coming next. So that the Confraternity edition basically died at that point as a publishing, publishable English text. Again, there's other English Catholic texts, other Protestant English texts. These are just the big ones. Okay, so let's hop over now to the Protestant side, the Revised Standard Version, 1952. The American Standard Version, which is a descendant of the King James, the Revised Standard Version came out. They took the American Standard Version and they fixed it based upon more knowledge of Greek manuscripts, more knowledge of Greek, and also just a little bit of a fixing up of the English. The American Standard, if you've got one, if you ever read it, it's very clumsy English. It's a very formal equivalent. There are two different philosophies of translation. Formal equivalence, that is basically trying to represent what's there in the text, even if you can, word order. Dynamic equivalence is trying to represent the meaning of the text, but putting it into equivalently good target language. So the American Standard Version leans way heavy on the formal equivalent side. If you ever want to see a really funny English translation, it's called the Young's Literal Translation. Young's Literal Translation. It's formal, formal, formal equivalence to the extreme. It's not even English. But it's a very interesting text. If you can't read Greek or Hebrew, Young's Literal Translation is kind of a nice helper. because he kind of just basically translates word for word what's there, but it's not very good English. The Revised Standard Version took the American Standard Version's formal equivalence and moved it a little more into the dynamic range, made it a little bit more nice English. So when you read the Revised Standard Version, you're hearing very highly educated, nice 1950s English, American English. Revised Standard Version, 1952. Okay, now, it's still got archaic forms in there, though, that weren't being used in 1950. Then the Catholics, because it was so popular in America and other places, the Catholics decided to make a translation of it, and that became known as the RSV Catholic Edition, 1965-66. So if you have an RSV Catholic Edition, that's it's probably that form, or it might be a second edition of that. Okay, then after that, the American Catholics made the New American Bible. It came out in 1970. New American Bible. The main source and organization of this was Catholic University's Bible Biblical Studies Department and Semitics Department. If you read in the New American Bible the list of contributors, and you know anything about history of Bible scholars and translation, your jaw will hit the ground when you see the collection of scholars that they had working on this thing. Now, some of you are listening thinking, what? Have you ever read the New American Bible? Father, that thing's a bunch of garbage. Okay, let me give you a little story that I learned. Some of you have heard this. I was at Catholic University. I did my PhD in the Biblical Studies Department. And Catholic University's Biblical Studies Department is world-renowned, especially in the Catholic world. And in one of my last Greek classes, I was with Father Francis Gignac, who was the chair of Biblical Studies and the Greek professor at the time. If you open up any New American Bible and look at the list of contributors, you're going to see his name in there. He's dead now. But I remember one time, it was a very interesting class. He was talking about, because throughout our studies with him, he would say these kinds of things. But this particular class he mentioned a few times. When we were looking at, say, a text of Luke, and we look at the manuscript variants at it, he would say, now look at that manuscript variant. That's clearly not Luke in Greek. Luke would never say it that way. It's got to be this variant, not that variant. Or no, it's got to be the text that's there. And we'd be in Mark's gospel, and he'd say, we come to a spot, and we look at a manuscript variant, and he'd say, now look at that variant. That's not Mark in Greek. That's some scribe throwing that in. Mark never writes that way. He would never use a participle in that spot. Well, we had been studying Greek with Father Francis Gignac for quite a while, and some intense history of Greek language and everything. And I raised my hand that day. It was one of the serious students there, one of the senior students by at this point in the program. And so I said, Father Gignac, how do you know that? I was a little embarrassed to say this to him because you should know this by now. How do you get that sense? And he said, oh, easy, Sebastian. Listen. Here's a good practice to get in the habit of doing, and you get this feel. Take a good English translation, like say the RSV, and then take a passage in Luke, Matthew, or Mark, where you got parallel text, and then back translate into Greek, compose a Greek text from the English translation, and then you compare what you did to what Luke did or Mark did or Matthew. And do this over and over and over again. Pretty soon you're going to start to get a sense of their own particular styles. Oh, that's ingenious, Father Gignac. I never thought about that. So then I said, Father Gignac, you said a good English translation to start with. He said, yeah, Sebastian, like the RSV. Now, just two doors down from this classroom is the office for the New American Bible. Okay, it's on the same floor of Caldwell, fourth floor Caldwell, Catholic University, just down the hallway, is the office for the New American Bible, the office for Catholic Biblical Quarterly, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. I couldn't believe he'd said this. We all knew that he was a major influence of that New American Bible. It was all, it comes out of Catholic University. So I said, Father Zinniak, the RSV, you said that's a good translation? He said, well, yes, Sebastian, you know, I mean, it's well accepted across the board. I mean, it's got a long history of, I mean, the history of editing of that thing goes back centuries. It goes all the way. It's been really groomed and it's well accepted in Catholic and Protestant circles as a good, and Jewish circles, the Old Testament, as a good English text. And I said, I know that, Father Zinniak. I have an RSV. I kind of like it myself. But why wouldn't you start with the New American Bible as a good English text? I mean, I was really a little confused that he would say something. Now, my vision of the New American Bible at that point was, yeah, it wasn't all that great of a text, which is why he was saying this. But it wasn't matched up. So he said, oh, Sebastian, you don't know what happened. You don't know what happened. And then everybody in the room, just eyes, you know, riveted on him. What happened? Because we were all wondering. And he said, when we were asked to make the New American Bible, we assembled the greatest list of biblical scholars in the entire world that had ever been known to man. The list of names of the people, the scholars, and if you go look at that list, some of those guys have 2 or 3 PhDs. Okay, these are unbelievable. That world's gone today. But we assembled them all. The greatest scholars of Hebrew and Aramaic and Greek and manuscript, you know, everything. And then we had our committees and we all worked on our text and we compared to other committees and we cross-referenced and made sure it was all good. And when we were finally all satisfied that we had a good English text representing the biblical text from Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek, we submitted it. Then the bishops ran it through an English lit committee. And they destroyed everything we had done. He was this poor guy, and he was so mad. And I said, what do you mean? So, well, they just ironed out every little subtle hint that we'd put into the English as if we didn't speak English, as if we didn't know how to speak English well. They just fixed our English. But our English was intending to represent subtleties that were there in the original text in good English, but still getting those subtleties there. But they just ironed it out. Every spot they didn't like, they just, oh, that's not good English. Iron, not that iron. And an English lit committee who knew nothing about Hebrew, Greek, or Aramaic, or had never read the Bible, destroyed everything we did. And I said, Father Zinniak, it's okay. I wanted to go up and hug the guy. He would look like he was about to have a nervous breakdown. And I said, Father Zinniak, it's okay. Can't we just take the work you all did originally and republish it? That was before computers. All of our notes were handwritten and on typewriters. Once we submitted our stuff, that's all gone. And besides, all the guys are dead now. Zinniak was saying this about 5 years before he died. They're all dead now. It's all gone. We could never reassemble the notes, handwritten and typed up notes and translations of all the original guys. It's all over. Well, here's some good news, though. The New American Bible since 1970 has gone through multiple revisions, and they actually have since that time, because many of the guys who studied under Fitzmyer and Zinniak and things, these guys who went through that program, who knew what they were doing, eventually became advisors for the New American Bible and eventually fixed things up. So the modern version of the New American Bible is actually a pretty good text. It's not necessarily the best. It's good American English, and it's the modern editions of it. And they come out like once a year. You know, they keep fixing stuff. It gets better and better. And it does seem to be getting closer and closer to what they had originally worked on. But the original thing will probably never be able to be recovered. So that's New American Bible, 1970. But notice I put dot, 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 dot. Okay. That's meaning it's an ongoing process. Okay. If someone does not speak English fluently, but they want an English Bible, I give them a New American. It's a good text. It's a new American, a new American, not an old New American. I give them a new American. It's a good English text, simple English. It works. There's some spots when I'm looking at the Greek text and I look at English translations of it, that the New American Bible is the only English translation I know of that gets it right in some spots. But in general, I like the RSV. That's what I'm kind of used to. So, but anyway, and then one last note on this, and that is the King James Bible went through another version. The modernization of the King James 1885 became known as the New King James Version 1982, which is simply the 1885 King James having the thous and these removed. So they made it into more modern English. It's still the same 1885 text, but instead of these and thous, you and your and stuff like that. Okay, so that's the New King James. It's a good text. It's got some problems, but I don't know of any English translation that doesn't have problems. But anyway, so those are the major English translation families and that are out there today. There are lots of others. There's things that are not really a Bible, like the Good News Bible. Good News Bible is a nice Bible to give to some kids or a teenager. Someone wants to read the Bible for the first time in their life. Give them Good News. They can fly through it. It's the Reader's Digest version of the Bible, you know. There actually was one of those too. But anyway, it's the Cliff Notes of the Bible, basically. It's a pretty good. It's good modern English. It's got some problems, but in general, 95% of it is going to be a pretty good simplified representation of the basic stories that are in the Bible. That's the Good News Bible. Okay, and again, there's lots of other Bibles or things out there that float around, like the Good News, like the New World Translation, Jehovah's Witness. These things are not really Bibles. They're misrepresentations of the translation of the Bible, sometimes doctrinally motivated, sometimes just for the sake of the reader and things like that. All right, so then, now one last note here on English translations, and that is this, well, translation in general, and that is chapter and verse divisions. Chapter and verse divisions vary among translations, as they are both relatively late. So we just talked about the history of English translations and only a very small part of that history. We could have this conversation about the history of German translations, the history of Japanese translations, the history of Slavic translations, the history of Spanish translations. Think about it. So this is a very narrow conversation we just had as far as Bible translation goes. We're talking about the major families of English translations, but there's many other translations of the Bible in many other languages, right? So with various translations of the Bible in different parts of the world, in different languages, you also have a lot of variations in chapter and verse divisions. The chapter divisions are relatively stable. The chapter divisions started in the period between 11, well, this is when Archbishop of Canterbury, Stephen Langton, lived. This is 1150 to 1228. He is the one who is considered to be the primary author of the chapter divisions as we have them. And for the most part, they're in pretty good spots. There's spots where they're not that great. Think of the very first division. Chapter 1 of Genesis ends 4 verses short, right? Chapter 2 of Genesis, verses 1 through 4a, for lack of a better division, belongs to the previous section. The first part of chapter 2 of Genesis talks about the seventh day. Well, the seventh day is part of the previous structure, the previous section. And then chapter 2 begins a new section, a new story. But in our division as we have it, we don't get to that new story until we get to chapter 2, verse 4b. Okay, so chapter divisions. They're in great. They typically are helpful to you. So I can say, turn to chapter such and such. They're useful. Sometimes they break up the text inappropriately and can then lead to exegetical errors as people are reading sections according to chapters as opposed to the text itself. Verse divisions come into the Bibles, a lot of Western Bibles, from the Protestant printer, Robert Estienne, or also as Robert Stephanus, who lived 1503 to 1559. And because he had the printing press, the ones he was printing, and the verse divisions that he stuck to the verse, the sentences, what kind of is what became popular. And so the verse divisions today, for the most part, are due to him. All right, so that is a general discussion of the Bible. We're way over time at this point, so I have to kind of cut it off, I think. But that's a general discussion of where we got the Bible, where did it come from, and then also how do we get our modern English translations. Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and the Holy Spirit, both now and ever, and into age of ages. Amen.